Chapter 2. Documenting Low-Quality American Democracy. The Income Bias and International Evidence. The essential point is that where the possession of political power is due to the possession of economic power or wealth, whether the number of persons be large or small, that is oligarchy. Aristotle, Politics. America features democracy by coincidence, in which ordinary citizens get what they want from government only when they happen to agree with elites or interest groups that are really calling the shots. Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, Perspective on Politics, March 2014. Financial support from wealthy individuals and companies ensures political success. While the U.S. system remains undemocratic in form, because freedom of speech and association is preserved and elections are free, in essence, it is becoming a plutocracy. Branko Milanović, World Bank, March 2013. The big data analyses examined in this chapter provide compelling evidence that American democracy is of a low quality. Public policy outcomes do not reflect the wishes of a majority of citizens. Indeed, independent scholars analogize the stratification of contemporary U.S. political outcomes with the behaviors evident during the end times of the first democracies in ancient Greece. Here is Steinringen. In Athens, democracy disintegrated when the rich grew super rich, refused to play by the rules, and undermined the established system of government. That is the point that the United States has reached. Both these governments came up against concentrations of economic power that have become politically unmanageable. Recently, scholars have examined the money-politics nexus in America, bringing to bear digital databases of unprecedented size and detail. Documenting an Income Bias. In his 2012 book, Affluence and Influence, Princeton political scientist Martin Gillens merged decades of data on federal legislative votes with survey data on both political donations and voter preferences parsed by respondents' incomes. Gillens found a statistical correlation between federal policy outcomes and the policy preferences of higher-income citizens. In contrast, policy outcomes had no correlation with preferences of other income classes. Money, the mother's milk of politics, is the root of representational inequality. Under typical circumstances, the middle class has no more sway than the poor when their preferences diverge from those of the affluent. The associated pattern of policy influence and political contributions offer at least one highly plausible explanation for the inequality in policy responsiveness to different economic strata. This representational inequality was spread widely across political domains, with a strong tilt toward high-income Americans on economic issues, foreign policy, and moral-religious issues. Moreover, Gillens found that this income bias has become stronger during the decades since 1980. My expectation was that representational inequality had grown in the U.S. along with the growth in income inequality. I did find evidence of this pattern in the steadily rising responsiveness to the well-off, but not to other income levels. Over the four decades covered by my data, in recent decades, the responsiveness of policymakers to the preferences of the affluent has steadily grown, but responsiveness to less well-off Americans has not. Like other research on the nexus of money and politics, the study by Gillens was indicative, but statisticians found his evidence only suggestive, a correlation. However, a more expansive and meticulous second analysis by Gillens, published in 2014 with co-author Northwestern University political scientist Benjamin Page, definitively documented for the first time evidence of an income bias. Their seminal analysis found a strong statistical causal relationship between the policy preferences of top earners and federal policy outcomes. The odds of the relationship they revealed occurring randomly are quite remote, making their analysis historically significant, a smoking gun. The evidence is compelling. America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened. Multivariate analysis indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. When the preferences of economic elites and the stands of organized interest groups are controlled for, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. Gillens, Page, and their research assistants evaluated 1,779 contentious congressional votes over more than two decades, beginning in 1980. Those policy votes were carefully matched with contemporary public opinion surveys on the same topics. The survey data were differentiated by respondent incomes, segregated into three income ranges. The 10th percentile of family incomes, mean income $12,200 in 2012. 50th percentile, $51,000, and 90th percentile, $146,000. The policy preferences of various interest groups, such as unions and business lobbyists, were also evaluated separately in the study. This encompassing analytical approach and huge data set enabled Gillens and Page to determine the likelihood that a particular policy outcome would be realized based on the specific preferences held by various income groups. They found that economic elites, and separately, business lobby organizations, have dominated American policy outcomes since the 1980s. Until very recently, it has not been possible to test theories of policy dominance against each other in a systematic, quantitative fashion. We have been able to produce some striking findings. One is the nearly total failure of the median voter to influence policy. In the United States, our findings indicate the majority does not rule, at least not in the causal sense of actually determining policy outcomes. When a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites and or with organized interests, they generally lose. You have just read the definition of income bias. Even more compelling, their statistical analysis occurred before the Citizens United ruling, discussed in Chapter 3, or the surge into politics in recent years of private money, corporate money, and independent expenditures by political action committees, PACs, and super PACs. Americans enjoy the trappings of democracy, including free elections, but they are only trappings. The most powerful political science analysis of our era has concluded that average Americans have little or no influence on government policy outcomes. There are certainly instances when the policy preferences of middle and low-income citizens are reflected in policies. But Gillens and Page conclude that such occasions occur only in the happy coincidence when high-income voters share those preferences. When preferences of top income earners conflict with those of low or middle-income citizens, lawmakers consistently ignore the latter two groups. The inconsequential nature of average Americans' political clout is depicted graphically in Chart 2.1, one of the most important in this book. If only 10% of top earners favor a particular policy outcome, the odds of that outcome occurring were found to be less than 10%. However, as the share of top earners favoring that outcome rises to 90%, the odds of that outcome becoming law increase by about 45 percentage points to better than 50% in total. In contrast, as the share of average Americans, the 50th income percentile, favoring a policy outcome rises from 10% to 90%, the odds of that outcome improved by less than 4 percentage points. Gillens and Page note, not only do ordinary citizens not have uniquely substantial power over policy decisions, they have little or no independent influence on policy at all. When a majority, even a very large majority of the public, favors change, it is not likely to get what it wants. Elites are calling the shots. Gillens and Page also teased out the influence of organized groups, including mass organizations such as the American Association of Retired Persons, AARP, or labor unions, on public policy outcomes. They found that business groups, such as the Chamber of Commerce, hold considerably more sway in Washington than even enormous groups like AARP and unions, whenever their agendas conflicted. These business groups are far more numerous and active. They spend much more money, and they tend to get their way. Lee Drutman, a donations expert at the nonpartisan New America Foundation, concluded in 2015 that the business community outspent such mass membership groups by a whopping 34-to-1 margin. This advantage was up from 22-to-1 in 1998. Campaign donations, or the promise of them, rather than membership numbers, is the decisive factor. Trade unions and groups like the AARP have vastly larger memberships than business groups. But the latter contribute vastly more money, the key determinant of influence. Other big data researchers have also concluded that lawmakers respond primarily to opinions of the wealthy and to business groups such as the Chamber of Commerce. See, for example, Kay Schultzman, Sidney Verga, and Henry E. Brady, The Unheavenly Chorus, Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University Press, 2012, pages XXIV and 8. See also Christopher Howard, The Welfare State Nobody Knows, Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University Press, 2007, page 198. The political impotence of average Americans has consequences because their policy preferences differ from those of higher-income households or from corporate groups such as the Chamber of Commerce. The preferences of average families include higher wages, environmental protections, stronger worksite labor protections, consumer protections, higher taxes on corporations instead of families, and an end to job offshoring. But their preferences are mostly ignored. Gillens and Page concluded that empirical support for majoritarian pluralism looks very shaky indeed. Evidence of the income bias in federal tax and spending programs. Further analytic verification of the income bias is provided by a separate study prepared under the auspices of the nonpartisan Washington-based Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Arlok Sherman, Robert Greenstein, and Kathy Ruffing utilized detailed budget and tax data from 2010 and 2011 in an analysis concluding that federal programs viewed comprehensively redistribute income upward rather than downward. The large national entitlement programs, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps, redistribute income downward, disproportionately favoring lower-income households. Yet when tax policies and all individualized federal spending policies are added to the data, their impact swamps entitlement flows, yielding an upward net redistribution by government. Most of this upward redistribution is due to large tax benefits, called tax expenditures by budgeteers, whose benefits disproportionately accrue to higher-income households. Examples include charitable donation and home mortgage tax deductions. The researchers concluded that about 30% of all income redistributed via entitlements and tax expenditures by the federal government goes to the top-earning 20% of households. See Chart 2.2. For every dollar redistributed to the poorest 20% of Americans by the federal government, $1.35 is redistributed to the highest earning 20%. Policy preferences of ordinary Americans closely mirror those in other democracies. Preferences of most Americans are largely ignored by lawmakers. Even so, ordinary Americans share the same hopes and aspirations as citizens of peer nations. Quite naturally, they seek to improve their lives and favor government policies that address such hopes. There are no comprehensive studies like those of Gillens and Page that assess causal linkage transnationally between preferences, incomes, and policy outcomes. There are, however, databases that provide evidence of correlation. The most comprehensive is another big data analysis by College of William & Mary professor Christopher Howard, using statistics from the International Social Survey, ISSP, a respected survey that documents citizen attitudes from Europe, the United States, Britain, and Canada. Reproduced from Howard's 2008 statistics, Chart 2.3 displays the degree of support among U.S. and foreign respondents for greater spending on government programs like healthcare or education. Americans were more supportive of additional government spending for social services and for education than respondents in these other wealthy democracies. And they were nearly as enthusiastic about increased government spending in the other areas surveyed, except running hospitals and reducing income gaps. Other surveys document similar support among U.S. citizens for such public goods. A March 2013 survey of public attitudes found that 53% of U.S. respondents believed it is a duty of government to provide government jobs if necessary to provide employment for all those willing to work. A separate June 2013 survey of rural Americans by the Center for Rural Affairs found that more than 80% of respondents supported more government spending for infrastructure, preschooling, and job retraining. Some 66% of respondents in a New York Times CBS News survey in May 2015 believed the gap between rich and poor is widening and that the distribution of wealth should be more even. Weak American efforts to ameliorate economic inequality. Americans have the same strong preferences for government income redistribution as citizens in peer nations. But government policy outcomes abroad better reflect aspirations of average citizens, defining them as higher quality democracies. The most comprehensive international indicator of economic policy outcomes are OECD statistics documenting the extent to which government tax and income policies change domestic income distributions. All 34 OECD member nations utilize tax and spending programs to redistribute income downward, drawing from the affluent to improve the lot of the less fortunate. In nearly every instance, such practices reduce the ex-ante market, prior to government redistribution, income disparities, although the magnitude varies greatly, as we now see. Utilizing OECD data, Drew DeSilver of the Pew Research Center measured the intensity of government redistribution policies through their impact on Gini coefficients. This statistical measure of income distribution, noted earlier, was developed before World War II by an Italian, Corrado Gini. On the Gini scale of 0 to 1, 0 value means that all citizens have the same income, while a value of 1 denotes that one person receives all income. The figures in Chart 2.4 are the changes in Gini coefficients as a consequence of government tax and transfer policies. The value shown for each nation is the net difference between the Gini coefficient calculated using ex-ante market pre-government incomes and the Gini coefficient calculated ex-post after accounting for the impact of government income redistributions. For example, the depicted U.S. figure is 0.119. That is the difference between the 2010 market income pre-government redistribution Gini coefficient of 0.499 and the Gini coefficient of 0.380, measuring income disparities with federal government taxes and transfers included, post-government redistribution. For comparison, the German tax and income transfer programs reduced its ex-ante market income Gini coefficient by 0.206 points, or by nearly twice as much as U.S. policies. The U.S. market income pre-government Gini figure of 0.499 is easily the most skewed of any wealthy democracy, reflecting the relatively large American income disparity. Even so, the American income redistribution effort is paltry compared to peer nations. In fact, only three nations, South Korea, Switzerland, and Chile, have weaker redistributive outcomes, not shown, than the American 0.119. Chile makes virtually no effort to redistribute income, and both South Korea and Switzerland have weaker efforts because the ex-ante market pre-government income disparity in each nation is dramatically more equal than in the United States. The market income Gini coefficient values for South Korea and Switzerland, respectively, were 0.342 and 0.372, in contrast to 0.499 for the United States. In fact, income is more equally distributed in Korea and Switzerland before government redistributive policies are applied than are American incomes after government redistribution, 0.380, as detailed momentarily. The relatively weak government redistribution effort means the ex post American income disparity is significantly more unequal or skewed than in other OECD nations. The post redistribution U.S. Gini coefficient of 0.380 is about 30% larger than values of the other large democracies of Germany, 0.286, or France, 0.303, as reproduced in chart 2.5. These are simply huge differences, emblematic of large middle-class economies, unlike the United States. In fact, America has the most skewed income disparity after government redistribution programs of all OECD nations aside from Brazil, Chile, and Mexico. It most closely resembles that of authoritarian Turkey. As noted, these outliers share American-style pay-to-play political systems. De Silva did not address whether government redistribution policies extract a penalty by slowing economic growth, a contentious issue not resolved until 2014, the year after his analysis was published. Until then, despite lacking evidence, conservative American economists, including the late Arthur Okun, had asserted that government redistribution policies slow growth and diminish economic efficiency. The flood of digitized international statistics in recent years enabled economists at the International Monetary Fund in 2014 to apply rigor to that question. They found the trade-off imagined by Okun and others between redistribution and growth to be mythical. The best available macroeconomic data do not support such a conclusion. The considerable redistribution conducted by higher quality democracies, such as Belgium, Austria, and Germany, does not reduce GDP or productivity growth. Indeed, American evidence suggests that redistributional programs can aid growth and employment by reducing inequality. A 2016 analysis by economists at the World Bank concluded that the increase in inequality from falling American household incomes between 1998 and 2013 reduced consumer spending by over 3%. The widening income disparities accounted for an overall decline in U.S. consumer spending of about $400 billion annually, slowing both GDP and job growth. The impact of economic inequality on U.S. social indicators has also been examined. In The Spirit Level, for instance, public health scholars Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson teased out the impact of rising inequality on life expectancy, teen motherhood incidents, and the like. They concluded that a number of social pathologies, such as infant mortality, addiction, suicides, and mental illness, grow worse as income disparity rises. Other data suggest these pathologies, already evident among Black Americans, have become especially evident of late among economically stressed white working-class Americans. Ronald Reagan, when American income disparity began to skew. As noted earlier, American income disparity is an international outlier, the most exaggerated of the wealthy democracies. We have seen how this profile emerged in the 1980s, when most gains from growth began to flow upward, with political scientists James Druckmann and Lawrence Jacobs confirming that the Reagan administration initiated this sea change. Its policies, noted in Chapter 1, produced a sharp reversal of the economic outcomes common during post-war decades. The shift in distribution of the gains from growth that began during the Reagan administration has produced the grandest income redistribution in world history. Compared to income shares in 1980, The amount now being redistributed each year from wages to profits is comparable in magnitude to 2/3 of the annual export earnings of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. Widening income disparity has also caused wealth disparities to skew. Back in 1989, the Federal Reserve reported that the top 3% of households held 44.8% of all U.S. wealth. That share increased steadily to 51.8% in 2007 and to 54.4% in 2013. A handful of Americans have grown startlingly wealthy. The 6 Walmart heirs alone, grown wealthy on inexpensive Asian imports and low wages, are worth as much as the bottom 41% of U.S. households. According to economists Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman, the wealthiest 16,000 Americans are each worth $110 million, or 1,100 times the American average. In 1979, they were worth about 220 times the average. The income bias originates with Republicans. Both Democratic and Republican lawmakers bear responsibility for the income bias and resulting failure of national policies to ameliorate rising income disparities or prosper middle and working class Americans. Bipartisan inaction has long protected the carried interest tax loophole, for instance, saving high-income hedge fund managers billions of dollars annually in taxes. But scholars have grown convinced that congressional Republicans are vastly more culpable for laws benefiting the wealthy and in derailing laws and regulations intended to aid the middle class. The scope of their actions is broad, ranging from resisting higher wages, overtime pay or minimum wages, and protecting extravagant levels of pharmaceutical profits to rejecting reforms that would punish Americans and other global tax evaders who use secret offshore accounts. Indeed, Republican lawmakers in states such as Missouri go so far as to preempt local efforts to improve wages, stripping counties and communities of the ability to raise minimum wages within their jurisdictions. Even some conservatives assign most of the blame for these and other behaviors that widen income disparities to Republicans. Prominent Republican and conservative Christopher Caldwell of the Weekly Standard, for instance, in September 2014 acknowledged the economic inequality for which Republicans are rightly given much of the blame. There's plenty of evidence that supports Caldwell's assertion. A 2008 analysis by Vanderbilt University political scientist Larry Bartels concluded that GOP lawmakers, senators specifically, are considerably more responsive to the agenda of high-income Americans than to middle-class preferences. In contrast, Democratic Party senators were found to be most responsive to the middle class, displaying considerably less of an income bias. Bartels drew on voting statistics from the 101st, 102nd, and 103rd Congresses, 1988 to 1994, to assess how the voting behavior of senators tracked the preferences of various income classes. The ideological votes he evaluated involved employer versus employee rights, raising the minimum wage, enforcing civil rights in the workplace, and shifting federal funds from defense to the anti-poverty programs Head Start and low-income energy assistance. Lawmakers from both parties tend to give little weight to the opinions of lower-income constituents. But Bartels identified a sharp partisan divide in the responsiveness of senators to the agendas of middle-income versus upper-income groups. And the differences he identified persisted even between senators from different parties who represent the same state or states with similar ideological profiles. Bartels found that Republicans paid no more attention to the opinions of middle-class constituents than to opinions of the poor, which is to say, none. See chart 2.6. In contrast, Democratic senators were most attentive to middle-class opinions. For Republican senators, there is no evidence of responsiveness to middle-income constituents, much less low-income constituents. The views of high-income constituents, however, seem to have received a great deal of weight from Republican senators on these four issues, more than four times as much as for Democrats. Democrats seem to have responded at least as strongly to the views of middle-income constituents as to the views of high-income constituents. Republican Party indifference to middle- and lower-income voter preferences has continued in recent years. They have enjoyed majorities in the Senate since 2010 and in the House of Representatives since 2014. Yet during that time, congressional Republicans have been loath to enact policies on a host of issues that benefit the middle class, policies that enjoy huge popular support, including higher minimum wages, providing employees advance notice of work schedules, mandating paid sick leave, or raising taxes on high incomes to sustain Social Security. See Chart 2.7. Such policies are commonplace in higher quality democracies. They are popular with Americans as well, including many Republicans, but clash with the priorities of higher income donors. Such policies also clash with the Republican imperative that emerged during the Obama administration to deny Democrats legislative successes. For instance, GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell was rather infamously overheard declaring in 2009, "The single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president." That strategy signaled to donors that the GOP was committed to meeting their small government agenda while resisting Democrats' wage, tax, and spending increases. Not a single Republican member of the House of Representatives voted for the Obama administration's economic stimulus law in early 2009 that averted a deeper recession. Subsequently, they forced federal spending cuts using contentious negotiating tactics, including a government shutdown in October 2013, the threat of another shutdown in September 2015, and additional threats that included contriving a default on the national debt. In a government whose architecture demands cooperation and collaboration for legislative success, polarization and gridlock became routine. Other scholars join Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein in blaming Republicans. Robert Kaiser, in his book Act of Congress, for instance, describes McConnell's partisanship in these terms. Refusing to cooperate with the Democratic president took precedence over legislating. He ruled out bipartisanship, because the term itself implied a truce in or even an end to the partisan wars. McConnell was no peacemaker. He never hid his desire to prevent Obama from winning politically useful victories. Congressional Republicans' gridlock tactics from 2010 through 2016 reduced the government's share of gross domestic product, GDP, spending by 2015 to the lowest in nearly a decade, reduced further by the Trump administration budgets. Discretionary federal government spending in 2016 was lower than in 2005, adjusted for inflation, including an 11% drop in education spending in real terms. Important R&D spending has been reduced dramatically. Only 18% of grant applications could be funded by the National Institutes of Health in 2015, compared to 32% in 2000. And although President Obama raised taxes on higher incomes, congressional Republicans have succeeded in reducing the overall American tax burden. Data from the 34 richest democracies collected by the OECD document that the U.S. total tax-to-GDP ratio declined from 28.2 in 2000 to 26 in 2014, nearly the lowest, 31st among them. That decline contrasts with the other democracies, whose average ratio rose slightly over this period to 34.4. Moreover, tax loopholes abound, leading the Sydney Morning Herald by 2016 to a headline, "U.S. Overtakes Caymans as Tax Shelter for Rich." The small government agenda of the GOP benefited its wealthy donors, but weakened the recovery from the 2008 recession. The government sector actually subtracted from growth in 2013 and 2014. It added nothing to growth in 2015, and little in 2016 or 2017 either. The GOP chokehold on fiscal policy placed undue reliance on monetary policy alone to spark growth. Then Republicans promptly took aim at monetary policy as well, seeking to browbeat independent Federal Reserve Board Fed officials into withdrawing monetary stimulus. Indeed, GOP members of the House of Representatives in June 2016 ignored salient issues including wage stagnation, widening income disparities, and job offshoring to question Fed Chair Janet Yellen whether the Fed was solvent. Economists were stunned. The Fed can create money at will. These GOP strategies presumably pleased donors, but reveal how far today's Republican Party has strayed from its 1850s roots. It has become a party hostile to the hopes of Lincoln for an activist government, expanding economic opportunity to meet the aspirations of average Americans. It has become obsessed with fulfilling its donor class agenda, relentlessly pressing for partisan advantage regardless of circumstances, as powerfully explained by Mann and Ornstein. The clear implication of McConnell's strategy was that if default brought economic hardship and the president and Democrats got blamed, that would be fine. That kind of calculus, putting partisan advantage ahead of problem solving, with the stakes for the country sky high, was not politics as usual, at least not as we have seen it practiced through several generations of party leaders. Because of the riches on offer from public policies, politics is always and everywhere a tough business. The Republican Party's Machiavellian strategy of slowing the recovery in order to diminish a political opponent is not unprecedented. President Grover Cleveland was victimized by similar tactics in 1892. But its intensity and duration is testament to the powerful impact of pay-to-play on American democracy. One of the most consequential indicators is Senate Republicans' refusal to seat President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland in 2016, which derailed a potentially progressive majority on the Supreme Court for the first time in 40 years. Indeed, billionaires, including Sheldon Adelson and Joe Ricketts, spent well over $10 million on TV ads in support of the new justice, Neil Gorsuch, whose 2017 confirmation has cemented pay-to-play for perhaps decades to come. The income bias is grounded in pay-to-play. The next chapter examines its roots in the decriminalization of pay-to-play by conservative Supreme Court justices since 1976.